Shri Ram Jai Ram Shri Ram Jai Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Shri Ram Jai Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Ram Om 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 Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om Jaya Jaya Ram Om Shri Ram Jaya Ram Shri Ram Jaya Ram Jaya Jaya Ram Om
Jaya Jaya Ram Om
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 Did I answer this one yesterday? What is transmigrating from life to life? Can you talk about Ishwara? Well, what comes to me at the moment is that really the gaining of this, the vision that Advaita Vedanta of the Upanishads, is not just that I am Brahman, just Satchidananda. It's I am Ishwara. You know? Because this whole Maya Upadi has Brahman for its being, but the one who's gaining this knowledge is embodied. This body, mind, sense organs person is the one who feels bound. And this body, mind, sense organs person is related to Ishwara as a part to the whole. And so to just say, I am Brahman, somehow the mind can, I think, just absorbing into my own being, just a non-dual conscious being that I am, even recognizing that this being that I am is the self in all beings or is the Adhishtana, you know, it's not enough. It's not enough because this body, mind, sense organs person has to be taken care of. The kartritvam, that sense of doership, that I'm a little pocket of consciousness that has to make my way through life, you know, to carve out my own life, to make my life a success, or to make my life meaningful, or to create a happy life for myself. That's what I bring to this knowledge. The kartritvam means that sense of doership. But in fact, as I gain this knowledge, this body, mind, sense organs, through knowledge, is recognized to be part and parcel of Ishwara, to actually be Ishwara. Be Ishwara means, like, this hand belongs to my body. Right? This hand is part of my body, or I can say it is my body. This is my body. This is my body. This is my body. All of this is my body. Or I can say, this is my leg that belongs to my body. This is my hand that belongs to my body. Nevertheless, it's all my body. And so, like, and it is all, the body takes care of the whole. The whole body takes care of all of its parts. Yeah, and all of its parts belong to this body. Yeah? So that's the understanding I need to have in terms of this body, mind, sense organs, that it actually is part and parcel of Ishwara, belongs to Ishwara, is Ishwara. And the self that I am is the self that is Ishwara is, and the upadis that I've identified with belong to Ishwara, is part of Ishwara's upadi. Right? It's just like saying in the dream, if you have a dream, all of the characters in the dream, all of the trees, all of the grass, the sun, the atmosphere, everything, the entire dream, right? Everything in the dream is part of the dream. This is the dream, this is the dream, this is the dream, this is the dream, or I can say this is part of the dream, this is part of the dream, this is part of the dream, or I can say this belongs to the dream, this belongs to the dream, this is belongs to the dream. Whatever I say, it is part and parcel of the dream. It is the dream. And then I have to, in reference to the dream, I recognize that my being, the being that the dream enjoys, and every part of the being that the dream enjoys, is the one self from which the dream comes, is sustained and resolves. I have to recognize that for my situation here, that everything that I experience internally and externally is Ishwara. There is nothing, there is no experience that is not Ishwara. The very self that I am, the Atma, is Ishwara. In that the Atma is Brahman, it is Ishwara's self, right? And so there's not that Ishwara has a big self and I have a little self. There's only one non-dual conscious being, which is the self, which is the very self of Ishwara, or I can say which is Ishwara. Ishwara, because Ishwara has a self. So I can say this whole thing, the self is the self, or this whole Maya Upadi, is Ishwara. And that self, which is Ishwara, is myself. And this body, mind, sense organs is part of the whole Maya Upadhi, right? Which is Ishwar's body, mind, sense organ, so to speak, body, mind. Whatever you want to say, Hiranyagarbha, Virat. So the knowledge has to be, I am Ishwar. The self that I am is the self of Ishwar. This body, mind, sense organs, every morsel of it, every part of it, internally and externally, belong to Ishwar. You can even say the ajnanam, even though it's pratibhasika, it's each individual ajnanam has to be removed. It's not apart from Ishwar. It's inherent in the maya shakti, vikshepa, avarna. Avarna is the ajnanam. That's why that verse of the Dakshinamurti, the last one we did, is so powerful, because it says, my salutations to you, Dakshinamurti, who are the one who is totally deluded and seeing everything different within the Maya Upadhi, because that one is the one which is you, with or without knowledge. It is the one, the self of the Ajnani, it is the self of the all of the animals, it is the self of all of the insects, it is the self of all beings, it is the self of Ishwara. So from the standpoint of the Upadhi, the Ishwara Upadhi has the Sarvajnyatvam, all knowledge, the Sarvashaktimatvam, all power, all capacity, because there's nothing that's not Ishwara. So he is total of everything. But every part of you is not separate, not other than Ishwara, including your ajnanam. You know, so Ishwar takes care of himself by having jnanam there to take care of all of the ignorant parts that are by the very nature of the upadhi, you know, is suffering from ajnanam. So my salutations to you, Bhagavan, who, you know, are deluded. You know, are deluded. Completely deluded on all sides, really through no fault of your own, but looking through the sense organs, you see nothing but duality. It's not Bhagavan's fault, it's just the way it is. And so there has to be knowledge. And so you who are deluded by all of this are also become undiluted by the knowledge which you give. Because I am you. See, that's the thing. You are Bhagavan, you are Bhagavan, you are Bhagavan, you are Bhagavan. There's nobody that's not Bhagavan. There's nothing but Bhagavan. And so, in this knowledge, part of the completion of this knowledge is that surrender to Bhagavan is not really an action, it's knowledge. I'm surrendering to what I'm already... I'm giving Bhagavan back what's already his. I'm saying, yes, okay, I didn't realize that. Everything about me belongs to you, including my own self. But that self that is you is me. That's why it's not their own. There is only Ishwara. You can say that. It's true. There is only Ishwara. It means Ishwara. With Brahman is the Adhishtana. There is only Ishwara. But then I have to be able to say, and I am that Ishwara. Because you can't say there's only Ishwara. Then you say, well, what about me? You mean I'm not there? No, you are there. You are Ishwara. There is only Ishwara, and you are that Ishwara. Not from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, but the body, mind, sense organs belong to Ishwara. You know? And so how, as a jiva, to live, with what attitude do we live in this life? Whether you're a jnani or a jnani, I do what, even without self-knowledge, I live a life of dharma. A life of dharma means my choices are always in accord with dharma, with the golden rule. You know, do unto others as you would have done to yourself. Don't do to others what you would not have done to yourself. Ahimsa, non-injury. Sometimes you have to figure out what that is, but that's the guiding principle. That's what matters in terms of your actions and your choices. It's not about raga dvesha. If the raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, don't conflict with dharma, there's no problem. It's just that the dharma is in is compatible with what you want to do. So that's no problem at all. That's great. Yeah. But if it's not, your likes and dislikes are not compatible with Dharma, then Dharma always comes first. Because Dharma is Ishvara. Dharma is the order, is Ishvara's order. You know? So you can say, if we operationalize, how do I stay in harmony with Ishvara? Dharma. Ishvara is that Dharma, you know. And so as a jnani, I still am going to be in harmony with Dharma, but I see everything as myself. I see myself, everything is myself, everything is Ishvara. So I see everything as myself, but I can also say, need to be able to say, I see everything as Ishvara. Because my very self is Ishvara. My very self is yourself. And so say you live with that Shraddha. You have that Shraddha. And the Shraddha becomes substantiated or becomes very, proves itself. It proves itself over time because at first you just have Shraddha. But then you see, you know, as you live your life that really the whole life is Ishvara and all of it is unfolding. There's so many gifts. And even if you're confused when something is happening, you don't notice, why is that happening to me? You still have Shraddha. You can say, let's wait and see. There's always something important to discover. Sometimes you have to wait before you can understand it. So you can understand your life much better in hindsight. And when you're looking forward, you have that Shraddha. And after some time, you don't even need the Shraddha because you just, it's how you're living your life. You have enough experience with living that way, you know, of trusting and trusting in Bhagavan, trusting in the creation, and the kind of the joy of doing that. There's a lot of joy in having that relationship with Ishvara, being patient, seeing what comes your way, you know, what there is to be done right now. All of the little sadhanas that present themselves to you because of the areas where you still need to grow, that's your work, you know. And kind of appreciating, receiving those with some gratitude, you know, because those are the things, those things that are sadhanas to me, those are the things where I still need to grow. And so if those things didn't present themselves to me in that area, I wouldn't be growing, you know. And so there'd be some constriction in that area that I'm not even aware of the kind of constriction that causes in my own self-experience, you know, and from the standpoint of my mind. There's not, I'm not able to have a certain level of relaxation that I can have, you know, that my mind can have when I accept the things that I'm trying to push away. You know, in the end, your heart has to be as big as Ishvara to be able to say, yeah, you can be with me, it's fine. Even do things that normally you would have said, go away. those things that you want to say go away, they're not going to go away. That's the thing. You want them to go away, but Bhagavan will make sure that they don't. Until you don't need them to go away. Then they can go away. That's how we grow. If you want them to go away, you better say, okay, you can be with me. And you practice that. Yeah. Ruthless. But it's the only way to grow, you know? So you can start to welcome those things. Like Swami Vagishananda, he's such a master. He's the greatest master at that. Come. More misery, but please. come. You're welcome to be with me. No problem, come. You sit right there. Have some tea. Yeah. He had such a good sense of humor. It makes it all doable, you know. Because you can use his humor. You can take on that humor for yourself. You know, when these hard things come. Some tea. You want to share my room with me? In regards to consciousness, what is the difference between living creatures and material things? Where is the soul and how karma plays in each soul's role? The difference between something that we, at least from our perspective, we consider inert, like for instance the rug and the chair and things like that, are things which don't have their own subtle body. They exist within each Ishwara's creation, and so in that, because of that, because sattva pervades the entire manifest creation on every level, it is known from Ishwara's standpoint. There is nothing in the creation that is not known. Just like in your mind, if I ask you to have any kind of thought or you have a dream, there's nothing in that dream that is not known. But from the perspective of the objects in the dream, some are knowers and some aren't. So the ones that are knowers are the ones that have minds and sense organs. So they have a subtle body. Whereas things like, to our knowledge, rocks and chairs and things like that don't have a subtle body. And so even though they are known and they have exactly the same swarupa, being the Satchitananda, everything has that as its adhishtana. Whether it's a rock or a person, it's exactly the same. There's only one adhishtana, and that's Brahman. But not everything has a subtle body. And the subtle body is what enlivens the physical body. So what I mean here is, like, the physical body and, say, the inert things are all made of materials, that the materials that are available here on the earth in this particular loka, right? Whether it's the body or the chair or plants or whatever it is, all of those are elementals, made from elementals, means the combination of all of the of all of the five elements, and that which allow for plants and food and vegetation and all the things that are here. But it's only the ones that have a sukshma sharira that have knowership and, you know, five sense organs and mind. And the ones that have the sukshma sharira are, the sukshma sharira is transmigrating from beginningless time, taking birth after birth after birth after birth. There's no beginning to that. So there's no beginning to the jiva, because there's no beginning to ignorance, right? So the jiva from beginningless time, all of the jivas from beginningless time are there. So what directs the transmigration that you would experience life in certain lokas, like heaven worlds and hell worlds, that are all temporary, and then be reborn here again and again and again? What controls that is karma. So karma there's two levels of karma. One we call drishta karmas, one adrishta. The drishta karmas means the karmas, now here it means the result, karma meaning the results of your actions. So we're defining, karma has many ways of talking about it. Now we're talking about karma as the results of your actions. Drishta means that which is seen. So the drishta karmas are the results of your actions that take place right here. Like, for instance, if I were an example that's being used, if I were a surgeon and I'm doing an operation, then the results of that operation are taking place as I'm doing it, and the operation could be successful or not successful. That's the drishta karma. But there's another type of karma that's associated with the action that I did that is reaping results. So the results of the surgeon doing the surgery are the success or failure, if I want to say just simplistically, the success or failure of the operation, right? But the adrishta karma has to do with the intent, with the ethics, with the morals. It's a moral result. Like, did I do the operation with every intent to save the patient, or did I do the operation with the intent to kill the patient? If I did that, if the patient died, but I had every intent to save the patient, there's the adrishta karma would still be punya, or it would be neutral. Punya means my whole intent was to save and to help. That's punya, or it's neutral. Punya means karmas that will result later will manifest into positive results, like taking a better birth, you know. But they'll manifest later. They're stored in what we call the sanchitta. They've not yet manifest. Drishta means they are happening here and now. The result happens now, like whether that patient lives or dies. Happens now. But the attitude with which I did, the ethical attitude with which I did that, is going to be stored in terms of punya and papa, where punya will result in positive experiences and papa will result in negative experiences. It's kind of similar to like sin, like doing something, good work, and doing a bad work, bad deed, that has a bad repercussions. So this punya and papa, the ethical results of my actions, you know, are stored in what we call the sanchitta, which would be stored in the sukshma sharira, to be manifest later at the appropriate time. And so because of this, you'll have many sanchitta karmas waiting to be manifest at the proper time. Those sanchittas, when you finish this particular life, the prarabdha karma, means the karmas that caused you to take this birth, are exhausted, and it's time for you to die. At that moment of death, the sanchittas, the karmas in the sanchitta that are appropriate for you and your next life and your next set of experiences will attract like a magnet. You'll attract those particular karmas. And it will also have to do with the time and the place and the era that it's in, which karmas fit. And where would you best be within the whole all of the lokas? Where would you best be considering who you are at this time in terms of punya and papa and everything? All of the appropriate karmas have to come to you, and you'll find yourself being reborn in this loka or spending time in other lokas, exhausting karmas, because there's a match, there's a fit. That's the idea. And so that's how you keep taking birth after birth after birth. While you're in this prarabdha karma, means the karmas that are exhausting now from birth to death, you're also accruing karmas, right? Because you're doing actions that are gaining karmas, getting drishta, seeing results, and you're also accruing punya and papa that's being stored in the sanchitta. So this goes on endlessly until you gain knowledge and you recognize that the Atma is not a karta. The self is not a doer. It has no karma. So in reality, you've never accrued any karma from the standpoint of your being. There is no karma. But from the standpoint of the upadis and this manifest creation, there is cause and effect and karma and punya and papa and all of these things that are causing the jiva to transmigrate and have different series of experiences. Try another one. What is the role of imagination according to Vedanta? In transpersonal psychology, imagination is a welcome tool to visualize and improve our emotional states. In the yoga of objectivity, in the yoga of objectivity, has imagination a negative role, considered as a way to place an exaggerated subjective value to objects or people, abhyasa or adhyasa, or ashobhana adhyasa? Can you clarify the positive and negative uses of imagination? Could you tell us also your personal opinion about it beyond the Shastra's teaching? I'd have to think about it, how the Shastra actually uses imagination other than upasana. We do use imagination a lot in the Shastra for upasana and visualization. You know, like in prayer, when you have a visualization, a very detailed visualization of Bhagavan or of an Ishtadevata or something, and then you just focus and hold that visualization. There's some rituals and prayers you can do. So we do use it like that. And one thing that gives us is what we call antakarana naischalya, which means we build up a strength and a steadiness of mind. But it's also upasana. There's also a certain karmapala, positive karmapalas, punya, from doing that upasana, because it's also like a ritual and a prayer to Bhagavan, where you're holding the image of the deity for a period of time and doing some sort of special rituals around that. You know, so we'd use upasana in that way. There may be other ways that it's used. I'm not sure. I'll have to think about it. But the way we use imagination in, say, in psychology, or what we found with it now, is it's just a very, very, very useful tool, especially in any kind of inner child work or in any type of dialogue with the psyche. And also we've found that the imagination and affect. Affect are embodied feelings. And the little ones in the unconscious are all embodied. So the unconscious, a lot of feelings have kind of been swallowed and are held in the unconscious. So they are embodied. And you can feel them, and you can go, when you're doing inner child work, for instance, you can go to the feeling, the affect, and then that affect will, it's easy to have an imaginal relationship. It means that that image will, that feeling, affect will give it image, like the image of the little girl or the little boy, or the image also more detailed, like the little girl may be sitting on her dad's lap or on the lap of the goddess, or it can be anything. It can be anything, and then that imagination is very useful. You can have dialogue with it. You can be present to it. You can be the witness of the little girl or the little boy in a healing relationship. You can enter into the imagination. Like, say, there's a lot of that affect is one of great fear, because when you were little, you were very much bullied by your family members or by some boys or girls in your age group or whatever, you know. And so that imagination can come up, and you can enter and go and relive those experiences as you, the adult, with the little child, who then has somebody, or it could be Spider-Man or Superman or, you know, Wonder Woman or something, can go and accompany that little child to confront the big bad wolf for the mean kids or whatever it is, and bring about some kind of resolution. Like that imagination I told you about when I was little, I reimagined my father coming and picking me up. That was very real. It was full of affect. The pain of him not doing that was there, the same old pain that happened at that time, the humiliation. And then I redid it. And then in the redoing it in an imaginal way, all that pain and things just kind of dissipated. It dissipated. And that little girl became really happy. You know, that shame and embarrassment and all of that kind of fell off. Though I had to do it many times, not just once, it would come back. Sometimes it'll help, but you have to keep doing it. But I'm just saying, But when I did that, when I, you know, you have the little girl or little boy so afraid or hurting so much, and then you can go be with him or her and then see, let the imagination do its work. But an imaginal setting comes, then be with that. Let it be there. And you can feel as you are in that situation, imaginal situation, things change. It's like a lot of the pain starts to be released. And at some point, let's say if you're sometimes that little child that you're with, you have to be with that child for weeks or months or a year even before it ends up releasing all of the pain and just kind of entering that pocketed thing that's been sequestered in the psyche. Just kind of rejoins the conscious mind. So it's no longer there. You can't get it back. You feel her, for me, because as a woman, you feel her just becoming you. You know, kind of like homeopathy. It just becomes you, and that thing that had been so sequestered now adds energy and strength to your own mind. So imagination is really very, very powerful and very useful, you know. Because you can do something about it. Like, for instance, if you're subject to catastrophic thinking, which many people are, you don't even call it that, but it's like you want something to happen, so your mind goes into imagining the worst-case scenario. That's what we call catastrophic thinking. You can change that. You can say, well, let's imagine what good could happen. Let's imagine it positively. And then you kind of reroute your tendency to go down the negative catastrophic path or to balance that off. Well, this could happen also, you know, so that you're not just building deeper and deeper grooves toward the catastrophic thinking, that you're getting a balance. And then finally you say, anything can happen. Let's see what Bhagavan does. This is all imagination. But you can use imagination so effectively to... That main understanding here that to take away with this, I think, is to know that in the affects in the body, the imagination and images, the affects themselves give off images. And you can come into relationship with those feelings, with those affects, and enter into that imaginal realm that they're giving you. And that can be so, so healing. It's nice for us to even know to go into our own psyche, into that imaginal world that's full of feeling, you know, and be in there in a positive way, in a healing way. So you gain a lot more, you realize the depth of your being in terms of the psyche. It's not just this conscious mind. There's riches in there, riches in the psyche. You can go into find wisdom figures who are the archetypes that are collecting all the wisdom. Like I say, you have a question, you can go into your psyche and ask for a wisdom figure. Maybe you have some wisdom figure that you call upon and ask, this is what I'm wondering about. What do you have to say? And it'll tell you. It's amazing. So learning how to have this access is so beautiful, you know. You can do it with devatas, with your ishta-devata, you know. You can also do it with each ishta-devata has an animal. You know, you can also walk with those animals and all kinds of things. It really gives you a lot of depth your home becomes a lot bigger. Your inner space becomes a lot bigger. Should do some of the upasanas sometimes, because those are usually some visualizations of Ishvara. Yeah. You'll have to look at that. Some of the Upanishads, like especially the Brihadaranyaka, has a lot of upasanas. The Chandogyas too. We just have to find ones that are kind of suitable for us. Pooja Swamiji says, the devotee is the basic person in the awareness of Ishvara. Can Radha please expand on the terms devotee and basic person? Can you say that the basic person is the objective individual without her raga dvesha? That's pretty good. What will you mean usually with the basic person is the one who is there just objectively, the prarabdha. You have this body, mind, sense organs, and the prarabdha karma that's coming your way. So say you, that's the basic person. Then on top of that, there's all of the things that we've picked up in all of our raga dvesha, all of our likes and dislikes, all of our reactions, you know, all of the things that kind of confuse the issue. But this basic person, I, am related to Ishwara, right? So what does that say? The devotee is the basic person in the awareness of Ishwara. See, the one person I'm always related to in all circumstances is Ishwara, right? I have different relationships with all of you and with the world, you know, but in all of those relationships, I'm still the devotee to Ishwara. In other words, my devotion to Ishwara is never replaced by any relationship within Vyavahara. So as the basic person, my basic relationship is with Ishwara. And Ishwara is the one who's going to always be there for me in this life and in the next, and in the next, as long as I'm taking births. This jiva will never lose the relationship with Ishwara, where who knows what happens when one of us dies. At least the ones that are left behind don't get to be in relationship with you anymore. We can have put you on the altar, which Swamiji suggested. If you lose somebody that's very dear to you, put their picture on the altar and do puja. When you do your puja, then part of your prayers will be dialoguing with that person. The reason that works is because if you've been with that person or know that person for a long time, you have so much of them, way more of them is inside than you can even imagine. Just like way more of everything is inside than you can even imagine, because your mind is filtering all everything, only taking in the smallest amount so you can function, right? But you have so much. And so if a person dies, we don't have access to them anymore. It's shocking, unbelievable that happens. All of a sudden, you don't have that access, but you do have access inside. That's one thing. But with Ishwara, that relationship that you have with Ishwara now is a relationship that survives death for the transmigrating jiva. That relationship is always there. I remember when I was about, I guess I was in my early 30s, I had some weird problem. It was actually hyperventilation, which was not detectable. They had to put a machine, I had to get hooked up to a machine for them to discover it. But it makes your blood the kind that I had, very acidic. So you feel very, very, very sick. You have no idea why. Nobody knows what to do. You know, so that went on with me for a couple of years, and I felt it was getting worse and worse. And I really felt, okay, I'm dying. It was very clear, I'm dying. And so I remember, because I had knowledge at that time. So I remember just realizing that really I belong to Ishwara, you know, and that relationship would never go. That I'm actually a traveler, all of us are, but I have sort of realization for me, and it gave me a lot of happiness actually. I am a traveler in the whole creation, all of the different lokas. I've been to probably all of the lokas, all of the different worlds, you know. I've had experiences everywhere, you know. And that will just continue. And so the relationship, my relationship with Ishwara is not going to be touched at all. I'm just a traveler. And I'm just a traveler here, right now. And when I leave this body, then I'll be a traveler wherever my karmas take me. But there'll never be a time when I'm not with Ishwara. You know? And when it's time for you to lose your body, or you think you're going to, then all of these kind of, your knowledge really comes to the forefront in a very beautiful way, you know. I didn't feel at that time I had Jnana Nishtha, you know, but I'd been with Swamiji for quite some time. And so that's what was holding me. And I was really happy about it. I was thinking, that's really beautiful to actually really feel that way, you know, because actually we are just travelers here. We're here for some very small amount of time. But we are not here for a small amount of time. We have been here from beginningless time. And your Atma, yourself, is timeless. So there is no time. But from the standpoint of the subtle body, you've been here traveling, taking body after body, doing this and doing that, everything imaginable, from beginningless time. And just because when you take this, the sukshma sharira, because of the karma, takes this body, you don't remember. But once in a while, like one child here or there will have memories that are actually verified. But that's not supposed to be how it is. It's supposed to, the system's supposed to close over so that you're not, you know, so that your mother wasn't your wife in your last life. Some weird thing, you know. You're not supposed to know all that. But sometimes things don't close over at that time. So anyway. Hey, we're going to finish them all tonight. That's why we got to have our ice cream early. The mind is sattva, but the avidya, which is rajoguna, avidya is really tamas. But the avidya, which is rajoguna, is in the buddhi. How does that go together? Can the mind receive, filter, take on all three gunas? If I hear a sound that disturbs me, or if I see an action, what takes place in my mind? Does each guna have both gross and subtle form? Is it correct to say sattva, hiranyagarbha, and maya are the same? Let's take it one at a time. The mind is sattva, true. But the avidya, which we wouldn't say the avidya, if we're going to say that, the most proper way to say that is you want to say that from the standpoint of the creation for the jiva, the avidya is initially, it's just the sattva, rajas, and tamas, maya in unmanifest condition. If we don't say that, you know, we can say that it's tamas. Rajas is the active principle. It's all activity. So you're not going to say that avidya is rajas. You would say something like kama, krodha, anger, irritation as a guna, as a quality, comes from the rajoguna. Because rajas is activity, so it would be, in a positive way, it would be power, energy, in a positive way. If it's dominated, if it has sattva underlying, then it's kind of the energy to get things done in a positive way, the wielding of authority and power in a positive way. But if it has a tamas underlying, then it's anger and irritation and that kind of energy, frustration, you know, that would be qualities of the rajoguna. Either, what do you call it? Influenced by sattva or influenced by tamas. So, sattva, the mind is sattva, right? That's the material. But that sattva can be influenced by rajas and tamas, because the mind is also embodied, you know? The sukshma sharira is embodied. And so the mind can be influenced by rajas, which can give it certain emotions like stress and agitation, or influenced by tamas, which can give it like dullness or sloth or just wanting to lie down or sleep, being sleepy. Those are all qualities that are attributed to tamas, whereas qualities that are attributed to just sattva, it's just shanti, tejas, where the mind is has that a certain brilliance, brightness, you know, and peace, calmness, that's sattva. So can the mind receive, filter, take on all three gunas? Yes, it's the mind, which is made of sattva, still takes on, becomes predominantly sattva at times. Predominantly, it's always sattva, right? That's the material. But it can be very much influenced by sattva, rajas, and tamas. When it's just being itself, it's sattva. But it can be influenced by rajas and tamas, just by the humors in the body, you know, and whatever activities are taking place can cause that rajo guna or the tamas, what they call tamas, to influence it. If I hear a sound that disturbs me, or if I see an action, what takes place in my mind? Well, first of all, say the mind is available. It's available to the sense of hearing. A sound takes place, and so a sound takes place. So the ears, sense of hearing, will pick that up. And it will be manifest or recorded or however you want to say it in the vritti. Right? The vritti using the ears will gain an image in terms of hearing of that sound. For instance, now to make that clear, say a sound is taking place outside, but I'm daydreaming. And I'm not using my ears. So I may not hear that sound at all, you know? If I'm concentrating on something and really concentrating, and the sound is something that just passes me by because I'm not utilizing my ears. If my mind is available to the ears, then I'll pick up that sound. So now that sound may or may not cause a reaction. It could just be a sound. Nothing happens to my mind except I have the experience of the sound. But you say it disturbs me. It's irritating, right? Because now what happens is, for whatever reason, that sound is not what I wanted to happen. What I wanted was just really to enjoy the silence and be peacefully concentrating. And now all of a sudden, the sound is coming. And it's not what I want. I want silence. And so now I'm having that kama. Kama is I have a desire for silence, and I'm getting it, so I'm fine. Right? But now the sound comes, and it's disturbing my desire. And so then I have a reaction, which is krodha. Right? And then the krodha is a type of rajas. The mind starts getting irritated and, you know, angry and whatnot. You know? So it's just that my desire is being messed with. It's really not the sound. You know, the sound doesn't need to disturb me at all. But it's going against my desire for silence. It makes me remember is when I was writing my... when I was getting my PhD at GTU, take-home part of it was a take-home exam. And I had like 12 hours or something to do this thing, you know. And so I was getting all set up in the morning, and then outside, there's a park outside my house. They started doing this mowing, and it was making a huge racket. And I was thinking, oh no, oh no, this is impossible. So I was like, oh, what am I going to do? You know. And so I had to go out and talk to them and like beg them, you know, to give me a few hours so I could finish this PhD, because I couldn't even finish this thing, so I couldn't even hear myself think. And it was like this life and death thing. I didn't want that sound. It really disturbed me.
Did they stop?
Yeah. They did. Yeah, they did. They gave me a few hours. Does each guna have both gross and subtle form? Yes, it does. But let me explain just a little bit how the subtle form gets converted into the gross form. When the creation first manifests, the sattva, rajas, and tamas manifest as the five subtle elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. And of those five subtle elements, the subtle element, the subtle aspect, the subtle guna of each one of the elements becomes the sattva of the five subtle elements becomes, each one of them becomes a sense organ, and together they become the mind. I can explain that in detail, but not takes too long. Then the rajas, they become the five, each one of the five individuals becomes the organ of action, and together becomes the prana, right? And so now, in terms of the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, you've taken care of the mind, which has its four elements in the sattva. You've taken care of the five sense organs, that's nine. And then you've taken care of the rajas, which is five, and the five karmendriyas, and then the prana. So that's rajas and prana, right? So that's it. That's 19 elements. So the subtle elements, in terms of the individual, make up the sukshma sharira. Now the tamas element is responsible for what we call becoming the physical world. So the tamas goes through a process of panchikarana, where each of the tamas aspect of each of the five elements splits in half and takes one, keeps one half to itself, like space would stay one half space, and then it would take, isn't it amazing how much knowledge there is? It goes on and on and on. So anyway, it splits in half. It splits in half. And each of the other four, you get an eighth of each of the other four, which makes another half. So space would be one half of the subtle element space, and an eighth, so 4/8 of each of the other four, and that makes for the physical world. So the physical world is only 50% of the element and an eighth of each other. So that's called making fivefold, because there's 4/8 and then one half, that's five parts. So that's what takes place to get this physical body and this physical world. So Hiranyagarbha is Ishwara, just on the subtle, just the subtle elements that have not gone, so that'd be the sattva and rajas. But the subtle elements of Hiranyagarbha going through panchikarana become virat, the physical world, right? Which is like the physical body. And for me, as Taijasa, the subtle elements, the sukshma sharira, the counterpart goes through this panchikarana to become the physical body. And the karmas are what is responsible for all of that to take place. Anyway. That's how that goes. Did I answer that? How did I get onto that? Where's my question? Oh. Oh, I see. Does each guna have both gross and subtle form? Yeah. Is it correct to say sattva, Hiranyagarbha, and maya are the same? No. Maya... So you have Maya is these three strands, sattva, rajas, and tamas make up Maya. Maya is like an incidental attribute of Brahman. Okay? So it's Brahman with this Maya that we say is Ishwara. Otherwise it's, Maya is mitya, so it has no independent being of its own. And Brahman is non-dual, there is no second thing. So Maya has its dhanam. It exists in Ishwara, but it has no being of its own to be a second thing. And so we say Brahman with Maya. We say Brahman with Maya, that is Ishwara. So Maya itself, it consists of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay. And so when the Maya comes into manifestation, the first manifestation is Hiranyagarbha, which are the five subtle elements that have not gone through this process of panchikarana. Sattva, rajas, and tamas that have not gone through the process of grossification. Once Hiranyagarbha goes through the process of grossification, it becomes virat. So you have Hiranyagarbha, virat, and Ishwara is just Brahman plus that maya capacity that goes into manifestation. So is it correct to say that sattva, Hiranyagarbha, and maya are the same? No. Maya is composed of sattva, rajas, and tamas. When the maya first manifests, the subtle five subtle elements, the sattvic and the rajas aspect, and tamas aspect that has not gone through panchikarana, makeup here in Nicarba, When it goes through Panchi, the Panchikarana becoming fivefold, we get the physical world that we call Virat. So. We're doing 1, 2, 3, 4. We always have 4 left. No matter what, we have 4 left. I'll do 1 more, so we'll have 3 left. Okay. Can the mind still be in equilibrium at the same time as you are happy or sad? It can be. Because this is why. First of all, the self is always the same, okay? But when there's happiness or sadness, the buddhi, if the buddhi objectifies that and welcomes it, the mind is complete, the buddhi is in complete shanti. And it's welcoming the ashanti. It's welcoming the happiness or the sadness, especially the sadness or the agitation or the hurt. And so you're still yourself. Yourself is there. The buddhi itself is speaking for you, you know, is your emissary, so to speak, or how to say that, it's speaking for you, acting from its from your own being. And so that equilibrium is still very much there, even though the sadness, hurt, anger is there. It's fine because you have a subject-object relationship with that and you're caring for it. So it'd be similar to saying, if I have, say as a therapist, if I have a patient, or say I were a doctor or something, I have a patient who's very, very angry and very, very upset. Does that mean, do I naturally lose my equilibrium, you know, or my shanti because that patient is so upset? Not unless I identify with it, you know. If I can be coming from myself, in my buddhi, I can be totally present and be helpful. I can be objective. Or I can be overwhelmed by it. You know? Or I can be overwhelmed by it. So, does that make sense? Good. Should we stop? Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho yam kshobha rahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate
Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.